Welcome to Fe y Libertad podcast. Today I'm joined by Professor Emeritus Bradley Hobbs, and we have a very special program today because today marks the 250th anniversary of The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. So here Professor Hobbs is an expert in Adam Smith. He is a professor emeritus in the Department of Economics at Clemson University, currently serves as a research fellow at the James Mason Institute, and he's also former president of the Association of Private Enterprise Education, and of course he's a longtime member of the Mont Pelerin Society. So thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, and I want to get right to the chase. 2026 marks the anniversary of the Wealth of Nations. You call it WN.
Yes.
And you call the also the theory of moral sentiments, you call it TMS.
Yes,
so we're going, from now on, we're going to refer to WN for the Wealth of Nations and TMS when it comes regarding the theory of moral sentiments. So WN was first published in 1776. Why do you think Adam Smith is still matters today? What do you think his work is still relevant today?
Well, one of the things that I do is when I use the shorthand TMS and WN, I use that in all of my work that I give to the students with the syllabi. But I make a big point of this. The actual title of the book is An Inquiry into the Nature and the Causes of the Wealth of Nations. So it really is the first modern book on economic development and commercial exchange. So I think that at the level of the world that we live in, the ideas of commercial exchange have dramatically changed the condition of the world, the availability of goods and services. Back then, of course, it was mostly goods. But we have economies like the American economy that have become very much a service economy. And that's part of the natural maturation of an economy. So I think that Smith has ideas in both TMS, though they're a little bit more abstract. It's more a philosophy. But in The Wealth of Nations, the concepts and the discussion around wealth and the building of wealth is important. And mostly with my younger students, my principal students, my freshmen and sophomores, I try to get across that the state of nature is really poverty, and it's deep, grinding, nasty, ugly poverty. Mm-hmm. It's poverty that they know nothing about. Mm-hmm. So one of the problems that we have, at least in the States, is that people are disconnected from what it takes to have a society that is well-filled. So one thing you can do with Smith is talk about that. And that's something that I think is an important thing to get across to students, is that wealth is an anomaly. It's strange. It's not what the normal human condition is.
Yeah, poverty is our natural state as humans. So we come to a world with nothing, basically.
We do.
And, you know, you can get students to think about it through the thing that's currently that they're aware of. So there's shows on television where they drop people off in the woods and they have to live for 6 weeks. And they all lose weight. They all struggle. They all have a very hard time, both physically and psychologically. It's interesting. I use it as a hook with students, and they seem to respond pretty well.
Yeah, so there's this topic that Adam Smith is the father of economy, but he was actually a moral philosopher. And TMS, you know, is a work that is involved in moral philosophy. So how do you think these two works relate with each other? Can we read them, you know, separately, or should they work best, you know, together?
Well, since I'm a lover of Smith, I'd rather have you read them both. TMS was written in 1759, mm-hmm. and it is a book of moral philosophy that is about beneficence. It's about how we get along with others in a society and how we judge our own behavior within the view of the behavior or the view that others will have of our behavior. He calls this muse the impartial spectator.
Mm-hmm.
And the impartial spectator is sort of an interior conscience that you have where you consider how others will respond to your actions. So it's an important book, I think, to think about how society comes together, what holds society together. There's a tremendous talk in the book about the virtues. I'm currently working with students today and yesterday on self-command is one of the themes, and prudence is one of the themes. And prudence is just the joining together of self-command and reason, at least for the ancients. So there's a lot there that can fit. Now, Wealth of Nations is written in 1776, so it's significantly later. I mean, so 1759, 1776, this is a book 15, 16 years after. And if we think about that, he also had a very interesting experience in between the two books. He became a tutor for the Duke of Buccleuch, mm-hmm. and they traveled around France, and he got to meet Ben Franklin, he met Benjamin Franklin, he met the physiocrats, and he also met Voltaire. So he was able in that period to travel throughout Europe and talk with other intellectuals of the time. And so the book is informed by that, but what he really does in Wealth of Nations is he pulls together a lot of ideas that are around and out there, but he's a great systematizer. So he brings this into a system of how markets work, how commercial exchange works, and why being human is important as a component of that, which is really linking it back very much to TMS.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period a number of years ago where I think people who had never really read Smith referred to what they called the Adam Smith problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
And that problem was, according to them, that he writes this book in 1759, it's about moral behavior,
mm-hmm.
and particularly beneficence. And then he writes this book about commercial behavior, and commercial behavior in the minds of many people can't be moral, though it is and can be and should be. And Smith does link the two. There are passages in TMS that presage what you see in Wealth of Nations. In fact, he uses the term invisible hand once in TMS. He uses it once in Wealth of Nations. For him, I don't think there's any disconnect whatsoever. I don't think there's any disconnect because if we think about the rules of commerce, they're often self-generated. They're mm-hmm. spontaneous order, which is kind of another thing that Smith has as a major theme, particularly in the Wealth of Nations, is spontaneous order. And these spontaneous orders come about, but they come out within a framework of rules. And that framework of rules are things that are human.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to respond? If you think about an exchange, if you go into an exchange and what I do is I try to claw everything out of the consumer surplus and producer surplus I can claw out from you, do you want to come back and have an exchange with me again?
No, probably not.
Probably not, right? So people that are successful in commercial exchange explicitly recognize that there is interest on both sides of this table. And I can't take all of the gain because what I'd really like to have is repeat transactions. So we have to form a relationship, and there also has to be trust in that relationship.
Yeah, it's what Montesquieu called the du commerce or the sweet commerce theory, right? Like commerce helps ease exchange, and humanity like evolves from violence and I don't know, robbery to commerce and
the world, and
peaceful exchange,
yeah,
right?
The world was a violent place. In mm-hmm. fact, Hirschman has a book that is a very good introduction to this. And the first time I seriously went through Smith, I read that book prior to reading it. It helped me a lot to think about Smith. Hirschman's book is called The Passions and the Interests, and the subtitle is Arguments for Capitalism Prior to Its Ascendancy.
Mm-hmm.
And what Hirschman basically, I'm of course paraphrasing in a short period, but the basic argument of the book is that The thinkers of this time looked around. They saw a world that was filled with conflict. Particularly, there's religious conflict, and the passions are driving this conflict. The passions, okay, and the interests, is the title of the book. So the passions were causing a lot of conflict, and particularly the religious passions. Hirschman said that these thinkers looked at that and thought, well, commerce is a place where you must soften your passions. If you don't soften your passions, then we're not going to have an exchange again. Mm-hmm. So the commercial exchange itself is a leavening, a deflation of the passions. It is a place where we can both pursue our interests and at the same time walk away from the exchange with enough good feeling to say, I'd like to do that again.
Yeah.
So I think it's for these thinkers, that's a great book to start with. And even if you didn't read Smith, it's a great book to think about, because we really have turned into a commercial society, a commercial world. Globalization, trade, it's just, it makes things available to us that we would never have otherwise.
Yeah. Now I want to talk about the impartial observer, because Adam Smith was mostly an observer of the society, and he went to a factory to see how things were done there.
Yes.
And when he was observing the factory, he came to the conclusion of the division of labor. So I want you to please develop, why is the division of labor so important in Smith's work, but also in economic growth?
Okay, so he is an astute observer. He's really a social scientist prior to the rise of social science.
Yes.
And he observes things, and he's not prescribing, by the way, that we live in a commercial society. He's describing the society already as it exists. And if we think about the division of labor, which is, I often say to my students, I can't think of a worse topic to start with from a marketing perspective. But nevertheless, you come to realize that this division of labor is extremely important. And the reason is because if we specialize, that means we make one thing. And obviously, I make economics papers, lectures, I have a weird job when you think about it. I talk to people about Adam Smith or other ideas.
And you're getting paid for basically talking.
And I get paid to do that. But obviously, I eat well. I've been on airplanes. I have some suit of clothes. And none of this are things that I made or do. I buy them through an exchange system. One of the things I've done with students, and I used to teach international trade and finance for years. And the first day that we had classes and we got through the syllabus, I would say, okay, I want you to think about what the world looks like without exchange, then write a short essay on a one-page to a half-a-page essay. And they start to realize that exchange is extremely important. We could never specialize if we didn't have exchange, because I still need to eat, even though I produce economics lectures. And that's true for the specialization of the world. He wrote about the pin factory. There were 19 distinct operations, and he goes through the numbers. He talks about if you had to make pens alone, you would only be able to make this many. But by the specialization, the division of labor within the production process of pens themselves, that they were able to produce tens of thousands of these pens in a day or whatever the number was. And that division of labor is also something that we kind of don't think about, but we take advantage of regularly. I think in a lecture that I've got, that I gave actually to a group of faculty, and I've given the lecture a number of times throughout the country in the United States, is that my grandfather was a country doctor, which meant that he did everything. He was the surgeon, he was the obstetrician, he was the gynecologist, he even had a lab in his house, right? And today there's about 160, I believe, different specializations in medicine. And what specialization then does is it allows people to become very good within a relatively narrow range. So you get much better training in a narrow range. Now there's a loss to that, and that's the generalized understanding of the way that the world works. And I think for young people that's a really important thing. They need to have a better sense of how the world works, and don't drive them to specialization immediately. And Smith recognizes that specialization has some downsides. It can make you a very dull person. And so I think it's a very important concept that is throughout Smith. It's something that we have today and we deal with today. But I also think Smith himself would say it's very important for people to have a general education, have a broad education, because we can get so specialized we don't see other things or connections. And one of the big things to see in life is connections.
Yeah, another thing that it's interesting is that through the specialization of labor, we each one of us do our own stuff, basically. Right. But in the broader, there's a broader process of cooperation that is uncoordinated. And here it comes, Adam Smith comes with this metaphor, which is the invisible hand, which has become a sort of a topic. Why did he mean by that?
Well, he uses it very sparingly. It's once in TMS, and it's once in The Wealth of Nations, and it's once in the book on astronomy, which is really notes from his students. And it's a metaphor for spontaneous order. I don't think that Smith had any idea that that term or that phrasing would become nearly as important as it became. But it is a very short, pithy statement, a very catchy statement, about the nature of a system that really is a system that grows from the ground up. Mm-hmm. It's not a system of order in the sense of from the head down. So it's not hierarchical, okay? It's anti-hierarchical in a lot of ways. And what comes together is a set of rules, a set of norms, a set of interchanges that people have that they do their own. They make themselves. They think up as they go. Language is a very good example of that. I tell my students that when I was in college and you said for me to Google something, I would have no idea what you were talking about.
And Smith, I think he had a lecture on language, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Smith had a lecture on language. Language is one of those things that's alive. It comes from the ground up. It comes from the people up. They're constantly bringing new words into the dictionaries. The old words get lost. When you read Smith for students, modern students, it's difficult to read. It's a little bit daunting, and it's because of the language and because of the length of the sentences and because of the length of the thoughts that he carries through. But spontaneous order is a concept that Hayek is very big on. And there's a lot of things in our world that are spontaneous orders. The one thing that I would use with principal students is the story I Pencil by Leonard Reed. Leonard Reed was the founder of the Foundation for Economic Education, or FEE. Yeah. And that I Pencil story actually originates way prior to I Pencil. And Smith himself has a passage called The Woolen Coat. And The Woolen Coat, if you read it, mm-hmm. is very much like a story of I Pencil. It's a mm-hmm. bit shorter. It's about a page long. But he notes the interplay between all of the different groups and people who were involved in the making of a woolen coat, just like Leonard Reed did with the pencil.
Yeah. So Smith, he's known as a classical liberal.
Yes.
And this is important because even though Smith defended markets and free markets, he also recognized certain roles for the state. According to Smith, what is the legitimate functions of the state?
Well, the number one function for Smith, and this is the theme throughout TMS, and he doesn't really address the state all that much in TMS. He really is addressing society more broadly. But the function is justice. Justice is extremely important. And in fact, Smith says that justice is the only virtue in which we can use violence upon others to enforce the justice. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that because if we don't enforce justice, then society will slide towards anarchy in Smith's mind. So Smith is not an anarchist. Smith is definitely a minarchist at best, speaks to the notion of firewalls between buildings, He talks about rules and laws that basically stand against foundational transgressions upon others, murder, robbery, rape, battery, these sorts of things. And he says that we should have a state that basically pursues peace, easy taxes, and what he calls a tolerable administration of justice. And I've always found that a very interesting way to say it. And the reason he says it like that is because he realizes that true justice can't come from flawed human beings. And that's a classical liberal idea. And so the flawed justice that we have, we don't know for sure. We don't have every detail. That is left to the deity, mm-hmm. As far as Smith is concerned. He says, if you want pure, true, honest justice, it has to come not on this mortal coil. It has to come somewhere else. And so he speaks of the deity having the true knowledge of your intentions, of your actions, the production of the actions, and the actual effect of the actions. So it's a big theme for him. Justice is, but also the notion of what the state's role is. But he is looking at a small state. He is not a fan of very large states.
He had these lectures on jurisprudence. I haven't read them, but I think he addresses this topic justice.
Somewhat. It's been a while since I've read the lectures on jurisprudence, so I'd have to go back and brush up on those a little bit. He's very much connected to law, mm-hmm. And justice within a framework of law. And that's interesting because Hayek, at the end of his life, basically turns to law.
Yeah.
Buchanan does a lot with law all through his career. It's interesting to see that economists can very much think about the framework of economic exchange, mm-hmm. and eventually that almost always turns towards thinking about law in some way.
Yeah, the design basically has to do a lot with economic relations.
And that design comes out in a spontaneous order. Law itself is a spontaneous order in many ways.
Yeah.
It's codified, but it's a spontaneous order.
Yeah. So also Smith criticizes mercantilism. And this, I already asked you this question last week, but I want you to develop on the topic. Do you think, or do you see parallels between the mercantilistic world that Smith criticized in the 18th century with, some forms of economic policy in the present day?
Oh, absolutely. When I was first introduced to Smith, my sense, and I'm not really sure how I got it or where I got it, but my sense was the book was really initially an attack on mercantilism. It turns out that it's a lot more than that. But that attack on mercantilism is a theme throughout. Not a friend of businessmen in a lot of ways. He says whenever they get together, they conspire against the public to raise prices. He's aware of what's going on with the East India Trading Company. Mm-hmm. Basically, what happened with the East India Trading Company is they went to the crown, the government, and they said, hey, government, if you give us a unique ability to bring in these spices or goods or whatever they are, let's just say pepper, for instance, yeah, we will be able to be the sole producer or provider for the nation of pepper. We will have a monopoly position. I'm sure they didn't say that out well. I'm not so sure, but nevertheless, they would have a monopoly position. Of course, the king asked or the crown asked, well, what's in it for me? And the answer is, well, we'll give you a slice of the profits. So the government acted as a provider of protection. It also acted as an enforcer of protection. That kept the competition down. This is good for the producers and for the people who work in that industry that the producers are protecting and that the government is protecting. It raises prices up, but consumers get hurt by that. And that hasn't changed. Nothing about that has changed. And one of the themes that the insights really that Smith had about mercantilism was their belief was that wealth was gold and silver. The more gold and silver you had, the better off you were, the wealthier you were. And Smith says, no, that's not true. What is wealth is production of goods for the people of the nation. I mean, it's really the first statement of GDP today, what we call GDP or gross national product, prices times quantities, and how, and summarizing that. So the wealth comes from production and it comes from efficiency in that production. Smith recognizes this. So he's really thinking a lot more about the people than are either the crown or the businesses. So Smith also, today, a lot of what we see is driven by this notion that the trade deficit is horrible. And we have a trade deficit, we must have a negative number, that must be bad. With my students, I tell them we can no longer call it a trade deficit. We have to call it the financial account surplus. This is a T account, it's an accounting framework. It was negative over here, it's got to be positive over here. So I have them call it a financial account surplus and it calms them down just a little bit. But to me, Trump is very much in his head failed by the Wharton College School of Business in his understanding of what the effects of mercantilism are. And what we have today is mercantilism. I mean, people are, businesses are, industries are asking for protection. Mm-hmm. It sounds great to people in the industry. It sounds great to the workers. And sometimes it sounds great to voters. That's really because of ignorance of the effects. Throughout the 20th century, the falling of walls, the expansion of globalization, trade across the world has created some frictions. There's no doubt about that. And I think what we're seeing today is some of those frictions. But we have to step back from that and say, my gosh, what has it done to my standard of living? And this specialization, this exchange, also allows for people all through a very wide spectrum of skills and abilities to engage in the economy in some way or another. So I think Trump is a mercantilist. He believes in that model. I'm not sure why. But yes, there's many reasons to read Smith today. In fact, they've become more powerful over the past few years, rather than less powerful.
He says it's because of national security, because it's a matter of...
Well, that's a very common argument.
Yeah, that's the most common of all. So I want to finish this conversation because talking about Smith's personality, because he was quite a character.
Yes, he was.
And there are like certain legends surrounding him. Like, for instance, the one that he got abducted by gypsies when he was a kid. And another one that I learned this from Mario Vargas Llosa, who wrote a beautiful essay about Adam Smith. And he said that sometimes people in his town caught him wandering around, lost in his thoughts. And it was very common to see him, you know, wandering around in the woods, or I guess caught up in his own thoughts. He never married. He lived with his mother probably his entire life.
Till he died.
Yeah. What can we say about this man's personality?
Quirky. That's not that unusual among people as bright as Smith was. He definitely had a thirst for life. He liked meeting people. He liked intellectual exchange very much. And he went to Oxford. He started Glasgow, went to Oxford. And he's quite disparaging of Oxford. Basically, he says that he engaged in self-study for 6 years because the professors were so bad. But Smith was quirky. There's a story about him in his night clothes wandering around down the beach and through the city. The gypsy story. There's a number of things about Smith. I wish I could think of another one right now, but I can't. I would have liked to have met it.
He would have been an interesting fellow to have a conversation with.
So what do you think it's his ultimate legacy, like his broader contribution to understanding society? Today we're celebrating 250 years of the World of Nations, and I want to think if in the next 200 years probably should we still be interested in reading him.
He was at the very forefront. If we think about the year 1776, and if we look at world GDP, particularly in the West, but world GDP starts up. It lags, and it becomes very significantly higher growth in the recent decades. But if we look at Western Europe, for instance, the 2000 edition of the Economist magazine has a graph, and basically we're stuck at about $1,200 per capita. And about that time, that thing clicks up, and by the year 2000, that's about $24,000 per capita, which is stunning, which means in a scope of about 200 years, or just over that, that a tremendous amount of growth has occurred for the people of the world. So I think that Smith presaged that. I think Smith offered a systemized view of that. And I think he tied it very much to human society.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bradley. It was a pleasure talking to you with this. Thank you for joining us today. And remember to subscribe and follow us on YouTube. And, you know, follow Instituto Fe y Libertad in their social media. And please support us in our contents. Thank you.